You are listening to A Window on the Past on West Limerick 102 FM. Yes, we touched on Drumkeen last week, but we said that we wanted to come back and kind of talk about it in more detail, didn't we?
Yeah. So we're going to talk about it in more detail today, as much as I can remember. Anyhow, what happened at Drumkeen originated, I would say, with the reorganisation of the RIC in County Limerick in... towards the end of around September, October 1920. Now, traditionally, Fethymore was part of the Bruff area of the RIC.
Right.
In other words, the district inspector in Bruff would be in charge of, would have number of RIC barracks under his control, one of which was Fethymore. Now, when they reorganised the RIC with the closing down of the barracks, you see, if you remember, there was a lot of barracks closed down in 1920. And when they reorganised it, Fethymore was transferred from Bruff to the control of Palace Green, the district inspector in Palace Green. Now, the thing was that Fethymore is only about 6 miles from Bruff.
Yes.
It's about 15 miles more, maybe even, from Palace Green.
Yes.
So, it kind of, the lines of communication are extended. Now, they had five RIC barracks under the control of the inspector in Palace Green. There was Oola, Doon, Cappamore and Palace Green. Now, they're in a cluster together. There's only about 3 miles from each one of them to each other.
Sure.
You know? And way over there, we'll say, in the west, at the western side, is Fethymore, 15 miles away.
Right, so it's an outsider already. We talk about 15 miles, like 15 miles is nothing nowadays, but 15 miles then, when people were travelling in considerably different ways.
And open lorries, you know?
Yes.
Anyhow, as I say, in their wisdom or lack of it, the British authorities, police authorities, transferred Fethymore from the inspectors in Bruff to the inspectors in Palace Green.
Right.
Now, following on that, the inspector in Palace Green, right, would travel to Fethymore on the last Thursday of each month, or the first Thursday of each month.
Now, how many times have we discussed the foolhardy behaviour of creating a regular habit at a wartime?
Well, you see, I think the penny hadn't dropped with some of the RIC.
You know, it's the worst thing that you can do at a time of war is to create a regular habit so that people will know, you know, that so-and-so travels this way in the afternoon on Thursdays. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyhow, they would pass through Carrick and Leash generally on the way to Fethymore.
Yes.
Now, the barracks in Carrick and Leash had been closed previously, right? But they generally passed through the Carrick and Leash area.
Yes.
And the Mid Limerick intelligence officer, a fellow called John Purcell, who lived in Carrick and Leash, he picked up on this, right? And now, whilst they varied the route a bit at the Fethymore end, they were very, shall we say, consistently foolhardy from Carrick and Leash on, or from, certainly from Ballyban or Kilbane on, you know?
Yes.
And they followed a fairly regular pattern, which took them by Drumkeen Graveyard.
Right.
Down at the Drumkeen Cross, down to onto the main road and then on to Palace. Now, along by Drumkeen, along by the graveyard in Drumkeen, was an ideal ambush site.
Isn't it? It's the ideal place for an ambush.
Yes. It was about 3/4 of a mile of a straight stretch.
Yes.
With stone walls, big stone walls on either side of the road.
You couldn't pick a better place for an ambush if you tried.
You couldn't pick a better place for an ambush. That's exactly it. And above at the top, before you came into the straight stretch, there was a gate facing down the road.
Yes.
Okay. Now, as I say, down at the far end, Powers Cross, there was a kind of a V. One road went off to Drumkeen Railway Station and the other one went off up towards Drumkeen Church.
Right.
Okay. Normally, they would take the road turning left down for Drumkeen railway station, you know. Anyhow, as I say, our friend John Purcell tumbled to this and he passed on the information to Dick O'Connell. Now, Dick O'Connell was over the Mid-Limic Flying Column. He was also the OC of the 4th Battalion based on Carrickalish. He would be, in today's terms, he would have been an Uncle Tom O'Donnell, the former TD.
Right.
Anyhow, Dick O'Connell decided to ambush them.
Mm-hmm.
But he realised that he really didn't have the manpower, enough manpower, to be sure of having a successful ambush. So he contacted Donegal Hannigan, who was over the East Limerick Flying Column.
Yes.
Now, Hannigan had a much more experienced and a larger column. Right? So they had, as I say, they had identified that this convoy, probably generally two lorries, sometimes three, but generally two, would pass through, as I say, on the last Thursday of the month.
Yes.
Now, they were bringing wages and whatever was said, and I suppose Sanson. Now, Sanson was the inspector in Palace Green. He was a Scotsman from Roxburgh in Scotland.
Okay.
Decent man.
Yes.
Apparently, it turned out he was a decent man, but very young. He was 23.
Is that extraordinary, yeah?
You see, this is the thing about it, that fellas in those times were, you know, responsibility was thrust on very young men.
That's like, what I'm saying. Like, I mean, if you think of 23-year-olds nowadays, I don't think you'd yeah. have them in the same positions of power, would you?
I'll tell you, I was, as I said to you, I was at the seminar in Abbey Leagues last yes. night, and about half a pint. No, they were speaking about the youth of a lot of the leaders.
Yes.
And I said, the man that was in charge of the Free State forces that captured Tipperary Town during the Civil War was a 20-year-old from Dublin.
That's amazing.
By the name of O'Connor, Patrick O'Connor. Can you imagine? A 20-year-old in charge.
Yeah, I mean, so, I know 20-year-olds now and I would consider them children.
You were there in charge of a bicycle.
Yeah. No.
But as I say, they were thrust into that situation. Like, when you think about it, like, O'Connor's was only 30 or 31.
Those were different times, you see, and when it's necessary, people do step into the breach.
Well, they have no choice.
Yeah, when it's necessary, they absolutely do.
Anyhow, as I say, the ambush was decided for the 3rd of February, 1921.
Yes.
Now, the two flying columns came together the previous night. They met up the previous night and they spent the night in a hay barn about a half mile from the ambush site.
Sure.
On the morning, they were able to observe the two lorries going out. You know, they passed on the morning going to Fenimore.
Yes.
It was decided much better to ambush them in the evening.
On their return, of course, yeah.
On the return journey. Reason being that you know, once the ambush is over, darkness will come soon.
Yes.
And it would be easier to get away to escape in the darkness.
Oh, yeah, you know? a good plan.
Oh, yeah, it's well thought out. Now, as I say, the ambush site was, as I say, running from McCarthy's house down to Powers Cross. Now, Powers Cross is a kind of road to the left and a road to the right.
Yes.
But they had this, just like a, you know, they had this, both those outlets blocked. But you'd be on top of the cross before you'd spot it.
Oh, very good.
You know?
Yes.
So, as I say, up at the top, let's say where McCarthy's was, McCarthy's house was at right angles almost to the road.
To the road, yeah.
So when the second lorry passed into the ambush position, the IRA, well, in, there was a number of IRA men in McCarthy's, right?
Yes.
And they just opened the gate, right? And there, as I say, it's effectively locking in the Lackentans or the RIC.
Okay.
Firing down the road straight at them. Now, there was, as I say, the Mid-Limic IRA were largely on the north side of the road. Again, a stone wall all the way down. You know?
Yes.
And the majority of the East-Limic fellows were in the graveyard, in Drumkeen graveyard, overlooking the road.
Right, you so know, they were well apportioned to they were,
yes, yeah. The RIC is, the RIC were in a terrible position.
Yes.
They didn't know it.
And they had created this vulnerability themselves by their regular passions.
They continued to lose. I mean, there was a variety of journey of routes you could take and could have taken from Palace Green to Fethermore.
Yes.
You know, but they chose the same route all the time, which passed by, dare I say, Drumkeen graveyard.
And put them in a vulnerable position. And it was just complacency rather than anything.
Well, I would say in so much complacency as a lack of thought.
They weren't even complacent, they were just not even thinking at all.
Yeah, you could say that, they weren't thinking at all. Now, as I say, when...
We know, even as we're telling this as a story, that the RIC are not going to come well out of this because they're not expecting it.
They're not expecting it. Now, as I say, the irony is that the man in charge of the RIC, Adam Sanson, was actually a very decent man, very honourable man, yes, as it turned out afterwards.
Yes.
He there were no repercussions, there were no reprisals. There were the houses burned, but there was no one shot dead.
Yeah, and that's an extraordinary thing for the amount of lives lost at
Drumkeen. There was 11 Lackentans or RIC men killed at Drumkeen. It was the biggest ambush or the biggest number of fatalities outside of
Kilmichael, yeah.
No, it is not even hardly registered on the thing today because the two people who led the ambush, Dick O'Connell and Donica Hannigan, both went pre-state. Now, the problem was that the Free State authorities kind of disowned the War of Independence during the, you know, in the early years of the
Commonwealth. It's a pity, like, because it's a pity to have such a revisionist view of history, if you like. You know, it is what it is.
It is what it is. Now, like, see, you've got to remember, Michael Collins is dead.
Yes.
Right? He was killed in the Civil War. Now, if Collins had lived, the chances are there would have been a more... there is a nationalist view taken by the coming year government.
Yes.
Now, some of the fellows, I mean, they were really, you're replacing, they were closer to the Irish Parliamentary Party than they were to Sinn Féin, at least some of them.
Yes.
You know, so as I say, I would say they didn't see that much in common with the IRA. Now, as I say, East Limerick, is unusual in that the two main men in the East Limerick area, Dick O'Connell and Donegal Hannigan,
went
Free State. Now the same would be said, mind you, of East Clare. Michael Brennan also went pro-treaty, as did Sean McKeown in Longford.
Yes.
And they were very active areas, like, you know, sometimes you get the impression that all the active areas went
Republican, yes,
they didn't. You know, the majority of them did.
Yes.
But they didn't know. Anyhow, as I say, the ambush started, right?
Yes.
It only lasted 5 minutes. About 5 minutes.
But you see, if something is well planned and well executed, it doesn't take longer than that.
Yeah, like what happened with the first lorry was that the lorry, when it reached the cross, Powers Cross, The diver spotted the barricade as he turned for Drumkeen.
Yes.
And he whipped the lorry around to go back towards Drumkeen Church. And in whipping it around, he turned the lorry over.
Right.
He hit the dishes turned over. Now, at that stage, the IRA opened fire. And the three brothers in the first lorry, Constable Burke, Pierce, and Smith and Pierce, they were all, Burke was killed. Smith and Pierce was seriously wounded. Now, the other two that were in the lorry were Sanson and the driver, John Cox.
Yes.
Now, Sanson and Cox, as it turned out, were dressed in civilian clothes. They were in the, we said, the driver and the front passenger seat, right?
Yes.
And they were thrown clear. You know, they were thrown clear onto the road. And they jumped up and they ran off up the road. Now, the IRA hesitated to open fire on them because at that stage, the RIC and the British military were taking civilian hostages.
Right. So they weren't sure. Yeah. They weren't sure quite who they were firing on. Isn't that another example of what we call the hand of fate in history?
Hand of fate. Now, you know, they hesitated.
Yeah.
Two boys got in over a ditch.
Yes.
Right. And they met a man out in the field spreading dung. I can't think of his name. It doesn't matter anyhow. So Paddy O'Brien is his name. He was out. He was a farmer out in the field spreading dung.
Yes.
And they ran up to him. Now they were in shock. No. And they forced him to take them back to Palace Green. Now I dare say, dung or no dung. Life, you know.
Oh, they were alive, and they were happy to be out.
Spinning off and alive, and you know. So they forced him to drive back to Drumkeen in the dump cart, right?
Yes. So they were out of the picture, and they were gone.
They were out of the equation. Picture.
Yeah.
No, the three fellows that were in the back of the lorry, they were seriously wounded, and Burke was killed.
Yes.
There was eight fellows in the second lorry. It was driven by a fellow called Stephen Milling, and it eventually stopped near where the graveyard was. And those men, they were nearly all killed, right? Bar two of them kind of were all wounded, and they were shamming dead. There was Samuel Adams, and either Michael Doyle or Anthony Foody. Can't be said, except for the second man. Now we know Adams, because he survived to tell Mrs. McCarthy.
Yes.
He said, the shinner shot me and I had my hands up, you know. But anyhow, as I say, we know that Samuel Adams was one of them. He was a 21-year-old from Scotland. We think the other was either Anthony Foody. Now, Foody would be in County Mayo, or Dyle. Dyle's in County Dublin.
Yes.
Now, Dyle is very interesting, Kyle, because Dyle was a black and tan, right? But he had worked at Gumses of Kilprush before the war.
Right.
Now, but I think it was Dyle was the man that executed the two, because they were executed, right, was Maurice Mead.
Yes.
Maurice Mead worked at Rails of Coola Loch, a mile from Gumses of Kilprush.
So Michael Doyle would have been known to Maurice Mead, and it would have been
vice versa.
Yeah.
Now, as I say, I can't be absolutely certain that it is Doyle, but I suspect strongly it is.
Yes.
You know. Now, as I say, the two boys would have known each other.
Yes.
You in the iron to those times, fellas living a mile apart, they're surely going to
going to come across each other. They are, of course, yeah.
Now, as I say, the thing was with Maurice Mead was, he went off and joined the British Army.
Yes.
Now, he was a regular in the British Army before the First World War.
Yes.
He wasn't a recruit. He was joined up because there was a war on. He had run away from home once or twice, and eventually in 1911, he ran off and joined the Royal Irish Regiment down in Clonmel.
Yes.
And he ended up fighting, you say, at Labasse in France in 1915, when he was captured and taken prisoner by the Germans.
Right.
Now, while he was in the prisoner of war camp, Roger Casement came in recruiting, looking for Irishmen to join a brigade that he was going to set up to come to Ireland, right, in 1916.
Yes.
Morris Meade joined him. Right?
Morris Meade would go where the action is.
Morris Meade was incredible, right? Now, Meade, as I say, joined Kirsten's brigade.
Yes.
He ended up with half a company, not a brigade. The brigade's supposed to be about 3,000 men. Well, Kirsten got 50, I think, or 60 maybe.
The brigade was a bit ambitious.
Anyhow, as I say, Meade, when it was realised that Kirsten's brigade was going over, they got a choice of going back into the prisoner of war camp and taking your punishment, whatever punishment would be given by the British officer in the prisoner of war camp, or else join the German army. But Morris, being the bold Morris, joined the German army. And he fought in the Middle East, with the German army in the Middle East, right?
Yes.
Now, when the war was over, he went back to Berlin. Now, I said, oh, he learned German? I don't know. I guess he probably,
and he probably learned it quite quickly.
Anyhow, he went back to Germany after the war. Yes. And he was picked up by British military intelligence. Right? He was brought back to London. Now, he says that they were going to execute him. I don't know whether they were or not, but either way, they decided eventually just to get rid of him, let him off to Ireland to hell.
Yes.
So he went back to Ireland, and when he got back to Ireland, his own regiment, that would be the Royal Irish Regiment, which was headquartered in Clonmel.
Yes.
They had an issue with him. So they got the local RIC to arrest him and bring him down to Clonmel.
Yes.
Where he was going to be put in a charge. Now, he got out of Clonmel. He escaped out of Clonmel. Apparently, one of the fellows guarding him had too much drinking one night.
Right.
And Morris managed to get away. But he now had, dare I say, no choice.
Yes.
There was only one place he could go, join the army.
Well, he had been everywhere else already, hadn't he?
Well, if you think about it, the British were after him, the Germans were after him. Well, the Germans weren't after him. But anyhow, as I say, the Royal Irish Regiment were after him,
yes.
Right? And as I say, he joined the IRA. Now, he was a great acquisition for the IRA.
Of course.
Because he could use every weapon.
Yeah, he was tremendously experienced. And, yes, dare we say it, ruthless because of his experience.
Absolutely ruthless. No crime about it. Like, at the end in Dunkeen, I don't know whether I said this or not, he marched the two men up the road to be executed.
Yes. And bearing in mind that we're 90% certain that he would have known one of them.
Yes. He executed the two of them, Samuel Adams and we believe this Michael Doyle. Now, he did a bad job with Adams. He didn't. He wasn't, dare I say, clean kill.
Yes.
The second man was killed cleanly, we'll say. But Adams, anyhow, was taken into Mrs. McCarthy's house.
Yes.
Obviously, the executions took place up near McCarthy's. They were taken into McCarthy's house, and Adams managed to tell Mrs. McCarthy, you know, the rudiments of the story.
Yes.
Now, this is where it gets a human dimension. Mrs. McCarthy wrote Adam's mother in Scotland, right? And she told her about the last minutes of her son's life, okay? And the two women stayed in contact for the rest of their lives.
There you go. You see, we kind of talk about, yeah, we talk about this as a kind of, you know, it's great to have the hindsight view of history, you know, and to be kind of dispassionate about it. But this is a human story, and it's very,
I mean,
you know,
he's a 21-year-old. He died in her arms.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's one mother communicating to another mother, like about the death of their child. Like it's a human story. Yeah. It's not just the numbers.
Human story, like, yeah, as I say, it's the one thing that I see it, that you can say that definitely happened. Like, I met Seamus Reardon. Seamus Reardon lives in McCarthy's house now, and she told me the story.
Yes.
How she had been passed down to him. Now, Mrs. McCarthy, her daughter was married to McDonough. They had a shop there in Roche Street. very nice grocery shop. And as I said, it was Seamus who hadn't told me the story, that the two ladies kept contact, you know, for the rest of their lives.
You have been listening to A Window on the Past on West Limerick 102 FM.